The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
And it really was an interesting philosophical argument that I think we still have today about on what grounds did women claim the right to vote. The radical concept is that you have a right as a citizen to participate in your own governance. In the end, that never won the day. Not that many people ever bought it, and I'm not sure even now sometimes if they buy it. What really got women the vote was the arguments and the campaign starting in 1900, after 70 years of working on this, that women were special, that women would clean up politics. I mean, the progressive era of the turn of the century is really a very corrupt political environment. And so you see the creation of the progressive movement, which is much to clean up politics in many ways, everything from getting rid of the corruption of having our senators basically appointed. All of the Montana election laws occur during that period, trying to deal with the corruption and the ownership of the political system by, say, the Anaconda Company, control of the newspapers, and the arguments in that milieu about women's participation, that women would clean up politics, that women, it's like housekeeping on a larger scale.
Good evening. This is In Other Words Radio, radio by and about women made in Montana. I'm Amy Sullenberg. This November, next week, is the 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage in Montana. So that's the centennial of women being allowed to vote. Montana men voted to allow us women the right to vote a century ago. So it seemed fitting ahead of this coming election to talk about women and voting then and now. And I am very lucky to be sitting here with Diane Sands. And I invited Diane to engage in this conversation about women and voting in light of our centennial. And Diane, welcome to In Other Words Radio.
Thanks, Amy. It's great to be here.
So Diane Sands is a Missoula resident, and I think she's lived most of her life in Montana. We'll probably get some details from Diane about the trajectory of her life. But she is a historian and a state legislator from Missoula area. She's running for the state senate this coming election, but she's been in and out of the legislature for a number of years. She retired recently, within the last couple of years, from the Historical Museum of Fort Missoula, so it knows all things history, and especially history related to women. So Diane, do you want to just jump in and tell us why we should care about the right to vote for women in Montana? What's so exciting about it?
Well, what's so exciting about it is if you're going to have a democracy, which this country is, then it's based on the participation of all of the people who are governed, the citizens of the country, to be able to participate in their own governance. And the majority of voters out there are women. And so, of course, their ability to be involved in elections and to elect people to their representative positions is absolutely critical to the functioning of a democracy. But I want to take issue with part of your introduction already. You talked about men allowing women to vote. Now, that's a really interesting way to look at it, because I was sort of being facetious. Yeah, the quotation marks would say that, in fact, you know, we often talk about women winning the vote or women being given the vote. And in fact, I would say it's neither of those.
Okay.
Women claimed the vote. Women, you know, they fought for the vote. It took 72 years for women in this country to achieve the right to vote at the national level. And that is a very, very long time to be arguing that you are, as a citizen, entitled to the right to vote. And that in many ways, the passage of an amendment or a law for women to vote, a suffrage amendment, is really the recognition of women's right to vote as a citizen. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. That is what Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton claimed, and particularly at Seneca Falls in 1848, the first convention for women's rights. And in fact, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's husband was so horrified by that claim that women, in fact, were equal with men that he left town.
Oh.
But from 1848,
did he come back? Or did
you get rid of him? No, they had many children. It was quite a happy marriage.
Okay,
but from 1848 to 1920, until we have the federal suffrage amendment, is a long period of women and men organizing to claim that right that goes through the Civil War all of the disputes among feminists over, you know, what happens when the Civil War, basically that era, grants a right to vote for African-American men but not for African-American women. And then the continual expansion of suffrage is a topic that's kind of interesting because we think of it as a point in time. 100 years ago, women got the right to vote, however, whether they want it, whether they were given it, whatever. But in fact, it is not all women, even at that point, who are given the right to vote. You know, even in the Revolutionary War period, there are some women who vote because voting initially in this country is based on property. Mm-hmm. So if you own property, and in some places where women who were like plantation owners get to vote because most voting and representation is based on use of your taxes and as property and property rights issues. So the extension of the right to vote initially doesn't even include most men. It only includes people who are white property owners. And eventually that's extended to allow white men, not all white men, but white men who are property owners. Then it eventually becomes an issue of women, African-Americans, some women, and later on, it wasn't until 1924 that Native Americans vote, because until then they're not citizens of the United States. In their own country, they're not citizens. That's the 1920 national suffrage in this state, the anniversary we're celebrating now, did not include all women in the state at that point.
Wow, that is, it's fascinating. I mean, I think 100 years, wow, that's a long time ago, and then it's really four generations,
right.
And I look at my daughter, and I think she would have a hard time imagining that we didn't participate in politics to the full extent that we can.
Well, the view really was that, you know, women and men occupied different spheres, and so women's sphere was really the home and the family, and men's sphere was the public sphere of politics and economics and the military and that, and it really was an interesting philosophical argument that I think we still have today about on what grounds did women claim the right to vote. The radical concept is that you have a right as a citizen to participate in your own governance. In the end, that never won the day. Not that many people ever bought it, and I'm not sure even now sometimes if they buy it. What really got women the vote was the arguments and the campaign starting in 1900, after 70 years of working on this, that women were special, that women would clean up politics. I mean, the progressive era of the turn of the century is really a very corrupt political environment. And so you see the creation of the progressive movement, which is much to clean up politics in many ways, everything from getting rid of the corruption of having our senators basically appointed. All of the Montana election laws occur during that period, trying to deal with the corruption and the ownership of the political system by, say, the Anaconda Company, control of the newspapers, and the arguments in that milieu about women's participation. The women would clean up politics. The women, it's like housekeeping on a larger scale. And the argument for women to get involved in it, because a true lady wouldn't really want to mess up her hands in that dirty world of politics. But the argument would be that in order for women to be able to do their primary job, the protection of their home and their families from corrupt influences and the other things that go along with social life, everything from polluted water sources to the issues of alcohol abuse, the massive problems with alcohol abuse that women campaign for the right to vote. The Women's Christian Temperance Union call it the home protection. The ballot is the home protection tool. That is why they support it.
Because temperance or the thinking about prohibition of alcohol was a big...
They're twins.
Twins. I don't think a lot of people...
Totally wrapped together throughout all of that, because it is the justification, again, for women to get involved in the public arena is because they're responsible for the well-being of their families. And that includes everything from, you know, the fact that in the sort of environmental world, you know, you've got polluted water and you've got sewage everywhere. And so until you really have good government that's going to clean up all of that and clean food movements, that a woman can't really keep her children healthy and alive in her family unless you have some kind of government regulation of all of that sort of freewheeling enterprise. And so the community welfare is at stake. The creation of schools. There is no safety net. Women legally, married women are not persons under the law. It's the other thing you have. It's impossible to understand in our perspective, but think of some Middle Eastern countries where a married woman literally, under the common law, is not a separate person from her husband. He owns all of the property. He can dispose of it without telling her or her consent. She can't even be the guardian of her own children. She can't enter into a business contract because she doesn't exist as a separate legal person. So because of all the problems that go with that, there's a necessity for women to claim that separate legal right. And so all of those feed into this milieu of political activism that creates a demand for women to vote and then women to use that vote to change the world, which they do. And that's why temperance is so important. I mean, the alcohol abuse was just beyond rampant. You know, men could go gamble away all of her possessions, could give away everything and lose everything.
And they did.
And they did.
Yeah.
And there was no social welfare net for women. That doesn't really happen until, you know, after women have the vote. So 1914, when it goes on the ballot and men vote to ensure that women can't actually vote. Mm-hmm. And so you have all these politically trained women and men out there around all these political issues. You know, Rankin comes here, who's just been running the campaign in the state of Washington. Ten states already have suffrage in the West before Montana. I mean, the first mention of suffrage in Montana is in the beginning of the territorial days, but it doesn't get much traction. There's a lot of discussion during the 1880s with the Constitution about women should be able to vote. Well, they don't think women should be able to vote on taxation and the big issues, but they do think women have a special sensibility to vote in school elections. So women from that period are empowered to vote in school elections because it's about children.
In all these states in the West?
Well, and in Montana, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Again, it's because it's appropriate to her sphere, if you want to look at it that way. And in fact, in the 1880s, we have two women, Helen Clark in Lewis and Clark County, who's actually half Piegan, half Native American, who's elected as county superintendent of schools. And there's another woman in Marr County. And you have Ella Knowles, who runs for attorney general on the populist ticket in the 1890s, even though women can't vote.
Did she win?
She came in second. Pretty good.
Yeah,
but, I mean, she's for our first woman attorney in the state.
Okay.
So there's continual discussion in the legislative and political and constitutional world about what's the appropriate role for women in participating in different levels and kinds of government. So, yes, participation in school elections, that's acceptable with that concept of women's sphere being the home of the family, but not entering into the political arena of the legislature or running for Congress. So
this just brings up many, many questions, but I'm sort of curious first. I'd love to follow the trajectory of how women started to get more and more involved in that, but I'm also very curious why Montana and some of these Western states, why we were ahead of the national, you know, 6 years ahead of the scene. Is there a reason why some of these Western states were a little more?
Well, there's a theory of historians around this. First of all, we're not the only country. I mean, New Zealand has the vote for women's suffrage. It's an international movement for women's rights. Mary Wollstonecraft is writing. I mean, there are many people coming out of the French Revolution, kind of the Enlightenment theory about participation in your government that the United States is founded on. So, but it is an international feminist and suffrage community, in fact, and related very much to abolition. The abolition movement of the Jacksonian period of the 1840s, for example, where in 1840, the world's anti-slavery convention is held in London. And who just happens to be there? Elizabeth Cady Stanton and some other women who were activists around abolition issues, slavery issues in the United States, and have been sent there as delegates from the United States. And because they're women, they're not allowed to be seated on the floor. They are seated on the second floor in the balcony behind a curtain.
Behind a curtain.
And so at that time, the women went, huh. You know, I think there's always a connection between when you look at the oppressions of other groups of people and then you look at yourself and go,
mm-hmm.
And you see that whether it's the 1960s and you have the civil rights movement and the student rights movement and the women's movement and all those come together because I remember watching the civil rights march on Washington in 1863 on my black and white TV in Fraser, Montana, where I graduated from high school and going, huh. You know, so how does that look when you put it on a reservation in Montana? How does it look for women? So those ideas of sharing, is it equality for all? Is it participation for all? Those are questions always get asked when you raise these things. So the idea for the women's suffrage movement in the United States came from the World Abolition Conference in 1840 in London.
And it took 80 years.
72 years from the Seneca Falls, 1848 until 1920, where it's passed at the federal level.
Okay.
But the campaigns in the West, as you ask, the theory of historians is, you know, there's activism on the East Coast, particularly among the more educated middle class and among particularly the Quakers and groups of that, the progressives of that era, many of whom have dual roles with abolition issues and anti-slavery movement. But it never is something that takes root politically on the East Coast. Most of the theorists think that the West, sort of that concept of individualism and freedom in the West, you know, that's really what epitomizes America, is the Western culture and ideology, not Eastern ideas. Some of the people who write about Montana and think about why in Montana, and when you analyze where the vote came from, you see this pattern, is that the passage of the Woman's Suffrage Amendment in Montana, which is fairly close, comes from eastern Montana and the rural communities, not from the cities for the most part, partly because it is so tied to the issue of prohibition. And that is the first thing that happens once it does pass, is the legislature puts prohibition on the ballot and it passes. So towns like Butte and Great Falls, with their huge brewery industries, et cetera, do not vote for suffrage.
Yeah.
But secondly, the economic analysis really is that in, say, Butte and the urban communities, men and women don't see each other's economic value in the way that they do in the rural farm communities. So in Butte, men are working in the mines. Women who are working as domestics or in restaurants or something like that, that has much less value in the society. Whereas if you're in a homesteading community, men and women work side by side. They see each other's work every day. They know that without the labor of those two people together, they will not economically even be able to survive in a homestead environment. So the economic value of women in those communities is much greater. And with the huge influx of immigrants coming into, mostly Northern Europeans, coming into eastern Montana and the plains and most of the West, there is a debate or an argument made that that's really a huge factor. And because the progressive movement in eastern Montana is huge because of the control of the agricultural market and for cattle and grain is being controlled by these monopolies out of Minneapolis and places like that. So the rise of the progressive movement out there is standing up to the farmers' union and all these groups, standing up to the corporate capitalism of the country. And those people, they get it. They understand what it is to be deprived of political power and your voice. And so that is where the votes for women are the strongest. And when you look at the structure of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, you also see it. There were, by 1910, there were 202 local chapters of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Every town had one.
In Montana?
Yes, in Montana. There's no women's organization that comes close to having over 200 local organizations now. Very strong, based in Protestant churches, fairly anti-Catholic. They do not admit African-American women. You've got the Montana Federation of Negro Women's Clubs being formed at the same time that work on temperance, community betterment, anti-lynching. You have segregation going on in the middle of all this. So it's not like the suffragist or some pure, wonderful people who have the
completely enlightened on all rights.
No,
correct. Yeah.
But so that's why it passes in the West and in Montana before it does nationally.
And you say it was close. How close is close? When
Bring those numbers, but it's fairly close.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a foregone conclusion would pass. And then, so it passes in November, and then the first legislative session is that following year.
Well, the work. I mean, it had to go on to the ballot first of all. Jeanette Rankin, who comes as a hired organizer for the National American Women's Suffrage Association. She's the staff in the state of Washington in 1910 when they actually succeed in passing suffrage. And then she is brought by the national organization back to her home state of Montana. And she and many others organize. She puts 9,000 miles on her car driving across Montana that one year, speaking at all kinds of forums. But you have other people like Hazel Hunkins from Billings, who also is a huge organizer and eventually works with the Women's Party, the National Women's Party, with Alice Paul, crossing the state everywhere. I mean, and every little community has suffrage organizations. There are men's and women's joint ones. There are many suffrage organizations out there. So it is a mass movement of a level that we really haven't seen recently.
Yeah, so they get the women get the right to vote. And then I'm curious how the pattern of women becoming more involved in politics and actually running for office.
Well, look at the
office.
Experience these women have gotten. So they've been campaigning like crazy from about really 1910 to 1914 is when it gets enough energy and steam behind it to actually start making it happen. So you've got all these women out there who are organizing forums, talking door to door, learning how to speak in public. I've seen their organizing forums. They're in triplicate. You know, you fill out, who did you speak to? Well, I talked to Amy today. I asked her for this. This was who was there. This is what she made a commitment to do. They're very highly organized. And so those women who have developed those skills in advocating for this public policy, speaking in public, raising money to be able to put on this campaign, then once they have the vote go, well, we have this agenda of things we wanted to do with the vote. I'm going to run for office and make sure that they happen. So Rankin runs for national office, the first woman in the world really to be elected to a national Democratic body, so she's the first of that. But she's not the only one. You have Mae Trumper, who's elected to state superintendent of public instruction. She's the first. There's only been one man ever elected to state superintendent since then. Well, Ed Argenbright back in the 70s or so. Again, I would argue, though, that goes back to we see that job as being particularly suited to women's sensibilities to children, which I think is a stretch. But historically, that's what it's been. Then you also had women run for the legislature. So, and two were elected, one as a Democrat and one as a Republican. And in this era, the Republicans are the progressives. The Democrats are not the progressives. So you have Maggie Smith Hathaway from the Stevensville area who runs for the House and is elected, and Emma Ingalls from Kalispell. She's the owner of the Interlake. She only served one term. But Maggie Smith Hathaway is fascinating. She comes out of, again, the temperance movement and as an activist Methodist social sort of social Christian ministry stuff. And she runs, and she actually serves several terms. And in 1920, she's the one who introduces the prohibition on alcohol. And in 1919, the Equal Pay for Equal Work bill, which passes. We've had that for over 100 years. She also establishes the first, all the things that have to do with indigent mothers and children. So we didn't have that before that. And Jeanette Rankin carries that at the federal level. It's the Shepherd-Towner Act that creates a safety net for indigent women with children. And then in 1920, Maggie Smith Hathaway is the floor leader. So she is in leadership. She's the first woman in Montana to have a leadership position in the legislature. And she has a long career working in the establishment of what we now call Department of Health and Human Services. But so that whole agenda of social issues, she then moves through the legislature. Because there's an organized lobbying group for women, the Montana Council of Legislative Women, which in 1910 has 10,000 dues-paying members and two full-time paid lobbyists, one of whom is Maggie Smith Hathaway.
Yeah.
So they are there organized on pushing this entire agenda, getting opium and laudanum out of over-the-counter drugs or being sold on the streets. So many people, particularly women, were addicted to those. Getting women matrons in the jail system so that it's not just men sexually abusing women in those environments. I mean, many kinds of things that have to do with violence against women, economic issues for women, protection of health, sort of the early environmental laws, all of those, equal pay for equal work, all of those issues, they carry and they pass many of them.
Wow, that is fascinating to think about.
We've been working at some of these issues for a long time.
Yes, and we're still working on equal pay
for
equal rights.
And violence against women and getting women to vote.
Yeah, you get to, yes, wow, fascinating. So this is In Other Words Radio, and I am speaking with historian and Missoula resident Diane Sands, who clearly knows her Montana history. How did you, have you always had an interest in history, and how did you gain all this great insights into?
Oh, I've always had, I grew up in eastern Montana on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation, and my parents are both teachers, so I'm very interested in history. And when I taught the first women's studies class here on campus back in the late 60s, and then went to graduate school in women's history, there were only three programs in the country back then. So I was trained at the Smithsonian back in the early 70s to do oral history, and we started a women's oral history project here in 1974 or 5, and have been doing various versions of women's history ever since.
Wow, great.
So it's a few decades.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so learning about history, is that what inspired you to become an elected official, run for office? Or
I consider myself more of a social activist, and history is a political tool toward that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first history projects that we did, other than a general collection of information about women, was an oral history of illegal abortion in the 70s. Because I'd been interviewing women about their reproductive lives, among other things. And so since I was a founder of NARAL and had done abortion lobbying in the 70s and knew of many of the illegal abortionists around the state, I recorded as history. So those things go together. I mean, knowledge is power. History is a political tool. You know, if you know your history, you understand both how long it takes to achieve many of these things, but it's also a great source of strength, I mean, to see the different strategies that have been used over the time, the different arguments that have been used over time, and the incredible power of people who are committed to making change over decades. You know, I think of myself and many other people as part of this unbroken chain of activists going back hundreds of years, in fact. You know, clearly I am a sister of Susan B. Anthony, as are you, and of Jeanette Rankin. Yeah. You know, history can be used in ways that disempower people. Well, you'll never be anybody. Your people come from nobody. You know, women never did anything important, so why should we even include them in the history books kind of thinking, to using history as an empowerment tool to say women have always been active in on behalf of their own lives in various ways. For the most part, it hasn't been recorded, but they have always been active on their own behalf.
So those oral histories that you started doing in the 70s, are those available today?
You bet. They're all in the University Archives and the State Historical Society Archives. We did them on many projects, everything from Women as Community Builders, which is a big project we did for the 75th anniversary of the suffrage. And that was a statewide project of the Historical Society, myself, some other women historians looking at women's organizations in the history of Montana. So we've done those, Women at Work, Women as Homesteaders, Illegal Abortion, many, many topics.
Yeah. I know that one of my co-producers on In Other Words Radio here, Beth Judy, spoke with one of the folks involved in MontanaWomen'sHistory.org, a whole website, and I think you're on the advisory committee there, but there is a fascinating and really neat website. Again, it's MontanaWomen'sHistory.org, helping to share some of these stories in recognition of the 100-year anniversary of the right to vote.
Well, we got excited about that idea. In 2010 was the 100th anniversary for the state of Washington.
Okay.
Now, their legislature provided $500,000, $500,000 to this women's coalition to do projects. And so
this was recently at their 100th anniversary.
Okay. Right, in 2010. Okay. So a number of us went to Spokane from the Historical Society and the Archives and MSU and U of M. And we started talking about what we were going to do for ours. And we knew we were not going to get $500,000 to do anything. But the Historical Society applied for a grant from a state source called Cultural Aesthetic Grants, which was our largest funded project for last year, for the Historical Society to go through all of its materials, pull out all of the stuff having to do with women, republish certain materials, put together this web page, et cetera. So that's a fabulous resource. It has resources for teachers, families, anyone who's interested in looking at what they have relative to women's history. It's now so beautifully organized on that website as a permanent source.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, thank you for doing that.
Oh, they did it. They're fabulous. So we did that project. Then we decided to do, under Anya Jabor's leadership from the History Department here and co-chair of the Women and Gender Studies, to do
with the University of Montana.
Yes, at the University of Montana, to do a touring exhibit on suffrage and citizenship, what it means for women. And it looks at all kinds of issues, like what was the opposition to women's suffrage? What are the issues around racism that were inherent in these discussions? I mean, the anger of some of the suffrage activists saying, well, you know, drunk men, Indians, African Americans, people who are insane, men, can go vote, and here I am, a white, upstanding, educated woman, and I can't vote. So there are really interesting and important things to understand in this history. So we formed a committee, a number of people who are faculty at the University of Montana, from the African Studies program to sociology, social work, et cetera, put all of our information together and created a traveling exhibit that is available. There are four copies of this exhibit, two of copies of which sit with the state library. So if you want to borrow it, it's very portable and easy to move around, and it's available.
So open to teachers or
absolutely
anybody who wants to use it for educational purposes.
Yep. The state library has two copies of it,
and
we have two copies here at the university. One that, as the president of Missoula American Association of University Women, AUW, we bought a copy.
Okay.
And then a group of women's organizations in Bozeman also bought a copy that sits in Bozeman.
Okay.
So those are available, and they're on tour all over the state. So we did those, and then I've been doing a lot of speaking around the state over the last year as part of the Speakers Bureau for Humanities Montana on a program called Taking Action, a Political History of Women in Montana, which talks about suffrage history, but also that goes into the contemporary, what does it mean to have the vote and to be a citizen in this country. And then finally, the last major project is Linda Moss, who was a senator from Billings, and I as a representative from the House, carried a bill in through the legislature that passed to provide for the creation of a women's history mural in the Capitol. There has not been a new piece of artwork of that kind painting since 1928, I think it is. So it's really a very big deal. And so we had a national competition for an artist, and in the end selected Hadley Ferguson from here in Missoula. Many of you probably know her as a great muralist, and it's a mural, and it goes on two sides of the walls up on the third floor of the Capitol and talks, you know, shows images of a lot of different women's experiences in Montana. And we'll be dedicating that January 7th.
At the start of our next legislative session.
At the start of the next legislative session.
So
we had to raise the money for that. It was not funded by public or taxpayer dollars.
So the bill just allowed the mural to...
Yes, it just allowed it to be created.
Be created in the Capitol.
Yes. It's a very big deal. I mean, there's so few images of women in the Capitol, so very few.
Yeah.
And so this means that I think many of the classes of school kids that come up, they'll be able to see themselves. Girls will be able to see themselves somewhere in the Capitol because those images do tell you something, like history tells you who you are. Mm-hmm. If the images in the Capitol are only of white men, what does it tell you about what's important and who's ever been important? And so it is an important message for the empowerment of girls to step up and take their place and be the leaders in whatever area they choose.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. I think that's really wonderful.
It's a great project.
Yeah. So today, fast forward to today, you've been in and out of the legislature. You're currently in the House. You're running for the Senate.
I'm termed out of the House.
You're not in the House. You're termed out. Okay.
Yeah, I spent, I've been involved in the legislature since the 70s, after the Constitutional Convention, first as a lobbyist and as a founder of NARAL around reproductive rights issues, then as one of the founders and executive director of the Montana Women's Lobby for a dozen years, which was a coalition of 50-some women's organizations, everything from child care to nurses to teachers and all kinds of people working on a variety of women's issues, and then served 8 years in the House, and now I'm running for the Senate.
And it seems like there are a lot of women running on both sides of the ticket and in the House and the State Senate. Do you know what the proportion is, men to women?
Is it still
biased or still lopsided?
Oh, extremely lopsided. You know, it's interesting when you look at Maggie Smith Hathaway and Emma Ingalls back there. We, for several decades, and had one or two women that'd be in the House or the Senate kind of thing. But it really wasn't until after the Constitutional Convention in 72 that we started to see any significant number of women, as in more than a handful.
Mm-hmm.
But we have never gotten above. We're right in the middle for the rest of the country. Basically, overall, we're around 25%. It goes up a few. It goes down a few. Part of that, I will still say, is because women don't run as much on the Republican side. The Democratic side, we have been in the majority. Women have been the majority of the Democrats, say, in the House. And this upcoming session, women will be the majority of the Democrats in the Senate. But the Republican side has not had as many women run or serving. For many years, there was only one woman in the Senate on the Republican side, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the argument about all that is why. So you get into the current, what is the argument of why women should participate? I would say that we've moved to the point where we no longer have to consider women who run for the legislature as exceptional. We're pretty much ordinary people who run and get elected, just like
dedicated
the men who run.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, some of them are really smart. Some of them aren't so much. Some of them are, you know, from every kind of occupation and have all different kinds of views. And some of them do a great job and some of them are just kind of there. I mean, and that's what I call equality. You know, you don't all have to be Jeanette Rankin, you know, to be there. But for some people on the Republican side, some of those women still don't believe that women's place is in that public political arena, that women should be staying more at home. And I would ask people to reflect on the comments of Sarah Palin. What was Sarah Palin's image of a woman in politics? Who was she? Tell me. You remember it, Amy?
Yeah, I remember. She was not, well, from my perspective, she...
There's a very clear Western image of how she portrayed as a woman in politics, the Mother Grizzly.
Oh.
And what is the image of a Mother Grizzly? Protecting her young.
Yep,
she's out there because of the family.
Yes.
She's out. Her job is to get out there and protect the family. That's why she's there, not because she's an inherently entitled person as a citizen of her country, as an equal to participate. But as the Mother Grizzly.
Okay.
And I always
laugh
at that.
Thank you for that reminder. I guess I was.
Well, and I laugh at that. It's such a Western image. But I kind of laugh at it because, you know, grizzly moms are single mothers and male grizzlies tend to eat the young.
Eat
so
the
it's
young and devour
not
them.
So good. But it is a very powerful Western image.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
But again, it's not that equality basis.
And my
for
ideas
running.
Are as good as their ideas. And those
well, things. They come. But women do have a different experience and bring that to politics, which is important. I mean, women still are primarily the people responsible for their children, et cetera. And, and so they do tend to bring a somewhat different perspective, some of them, but others are business people or have different perspectives to bring to it. So in my view, our right to be there and participate is based on the equality argument, not on a special rights argument.
Right.
But even if you have the right to vote, it doesn't necessarily mean you can exercise it. I mean, it's so interesting looking at suffrage history in that regard because once the vote has been won or claimed, doesn't mean that forces don't try to stop you from exercising it. Hence, you know, certainly after the Civil War, although African-American men had the right to vote, you start seeing poll taxes, the lynching campaigns, demand that you be able to read or present certain credentials in order to vote, which still goes on. And now you
and
have...
And is actually in a resurgence.
Yes, it is in a resurgence.
Yeah, across the country. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
And relative to Native Americans in this state, we have seen those issues. About, I know it's a little more than 10 years ago, there were issues for Native Americans in Montana, first starting with county elections, that the way we did redistricting, which the Constitution requires every 10 years, actually had drawn those lines in a way that in a number of cases there were not enough Native American votes in one district to allow them to reasonably expect that they could elect someone representing their own interest. And that went to the court, and the court said, yeah, you're right, there's a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the drawing of the district lines was changed so that, say, the Blackfeet Reservation and the Flathead Reservation now share a Senate seat. So it leaps over Glacier Park, but it allows for enough concentration of Native American voters to be able to reasonably expect that they can elect someone. And after all of that, you know, we started to see some fairly significant numbers. I think the highest number was 12 or 14 in one session of Native Americans in both the House and the Senate. The numbers are way down right now, but that's been an important factor. And then just this last year, we had, in the last few months, a challenge to the Secretary of State's office down in the Crow and Northern Cheyenne Reservation about where a polling place was. Yeah, it's fine if you can say you can vote, but if you can't get to the polling place because you don't have a car and the only polling place is 100 miles at the county seat, then you have been structurally denied a right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the claim down there, that they wouldn't put these satellite voting
and
places down there.
And they have now placed a few. Is that true?
Yes, because the court said you must do that. It is an issue of access, and the Constitution guarantees, you know, whatever reasonable means to create the possibility of access. Now you get to the legislative referenda that's on the ballot this fall, to roll back access to voting on Election Day. And I actually, when I worked for the Senate, was the organizer that designed that law. I mean, I feel very strongly about
that. The one that passed that said we will have expand our voting.
Right, that you can register and vote up and through Election Day. Okay.
Yeah, Diane, let me just interrupt for one second. Let's talk about LR 126. But I just want to interject and say that this is In Other Words Radio. I'm Amy Sullenberg speaking with Diane Sands here in Missoula, and we are 1 week out from a general election, and it is very timely to be speaking about these issues.
Well, November 3rd, the day before our Election Day, is the actual 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in Montana.
Right. So we, you know, it does strike me as a little bit crazy that 100 years ago we were fighting for the right to vote for women, and now we are seeing this upswing in people and laws and policies that are pulling back from making it easy and readily available and democratic to vote.
So we're always expanding it and then fighting it, you know. So in the 72 Constitution, we expanded the vote for 18-year-olds down from 21 even before in Montana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the expansion of people who have served their term in prison as a felon. Once they're outside of that in the state, their voting rights are restored. You know, it's not a point in time 100 years ago.
Okay.
It was all
Thank
over
you.
Then.
Yeah.
Women being able to vote, right. Native American women, 1924. Japanese Americans and all, many of those, not till 1954. So this is a process, and it has to be continually claimed. And if people don't exercise the vote and the discouragement that people have at voting, that actually, the suppression of the vote. And you can do that a lot of ways. You can say you have to show.
As we're seeing around the country. Yeah.
Yes, very much around the country, saying you have to be able to show a certain ID, even though there's no evidence of fraud in Montana. I mean, our voting laws are very strong. I'm also a polling place manager. I have 14 hours of training to oversee a polling place. Our laws are very clear. We really don't have any history of that kind of corruption, and yet you have this continual demand to cut back on people's access to being able to vote. I mean, it's something people have got to be aware of and stand up to.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's a very large and vocal campaign to vote no on LR 126, and I do hope for all of us that we can keep that.
Well, and people, sometimes they don't go all the way down the ballot. They need to look at that, because the way it's been is you can register and vote up through Election Day. And more and more people have been using that. And, you know, the argument is they should have gotten off their butts and done it on the Friday before. And, yes, that's true for a lot of people. Maybe that's the case. But I know as a polling place manager, I see people every election who think they registered, particularly with the driver's license issue, that they think they filled out a form there, checked the box, and maybe they didn't, or maybe, you know, the DMV didn't get it in. Whatever the case might be, I can tell them, I don't know what happened, but you can register and vote today, and you can go down to the election office, and you can still vote.
Right. And it seems that there's a lot of, if we're talking about women here, there's a lot of women that may have moved recently, may have, you know, single moms with their families, and all of a sudden.
Last time I moved, the first thing I didn't think of was I better go change my voter registration.
Right, and if you know that you can still do it, people do sometimes do it at the last minute, but that doesn't mean it's any less important.
And just because it's an administrative problem, and we worked that out really well, I think Missoula in particular has gotten many more people there so that they can fill out the forms faster, and they've separated out the lines so it's efficient. More efficient. But, you know, most of the call to get that rolled back comes from people in really Republican legislators in rural areas. And they tried to do this several times in the legislature, and the governor vetoed it, saying it's suppression of the ballot. But when you look at the places out there, like Macon County, I remember arguing this on the floor, and representative, now let's see, in Macon County, three people use this on Election Day. Are you telling me that you couldn't handle three people?
Right.
You know, this is not such an onerous burden out there that you can't handle it. It's an important way of expanding the rights of people who are qualified to vote to actually be able to vote.
Right. And it seems a bit disingenuous. A number of the people that are now suggesting we vote for LR 126 are the same people that voted for the bill that you worked on, the expansion bill, back
It passed almost unanimously, came out of the Senate unanimously. Brad Johnson, who was the Republican Secretary of State, was very supportive of it. It had no opposition at that time. The reason it has opposition now is because many of the Republicans in the legislature believe that it really helps Democrats. That's really not the case if you look at the states that have it. It, you know, It can help helps Democrats some elections, Republicans at others. It is not specific to that issue at all. But in the 06 election, because medical marijuana was on the ballot and you had so many people go in and vote at the last minute on it, it really caused quite a stir. We haven't seen that kind of reaction since. But it's your right to vote. About 7,000 people will lose their right to who've used it will lose that right to vote if we don't if you don't get out there and vote no on that.
So I do hope that listeners out there know that if they're not registered to vote, they still can, and they have an opportunity to vote up and through November 4th, our election day. And let's see. Yeah, this we'll have this show posted on our website, inotherwordsradio.com, if you want to share this show with any of your friends, neighbors. Feel free to pass around the link if you didn't catch the whole show. Again, I'm speaking with Diane Sands.
Well, let me tell you a little story that I think is so important. You know, people don't think their vote matters in a lot of cases. And I think the sad part of all of the federal inaction and the mess, the inaction at the federal level is so darn discouraging that people just say, I'm just not going to bother. It's just totally worthless to vote. You know, in some ways, that's a plan to deny you your right to participate. And don't give it to them. Don't allow that level of negativity at the federal level to deny you your vote. Here's an example of where one vote made all the difference in the world, and it's because of women's suffrage. We would not have had the women's suffrage federal amendment pass except for one vote by one man and one mother. An amendment to the federal constitution, once it passes Congress, they put it out to the states for ratification, and the majority of the states have to
Two-thirds have to vote yes.
Well, it got down to the last state that was eligible to vote, Tennessee, and a huge battle going on, of course. The symbol for the people who were for suffrage was the sunflower coming out of Kansas, one of the early states, and the red rose was the symbol of anti-suffrage people. Well, one young man who was 27, he was a first-term legislator, was already committed to voting against suffrage. He didn't think this was a good idea. On the day of the vote, his mother talked to him and wrote him and begged him to change his vote to allow her to vote and women to vote. He walked into the floor of the Tennessee legislature, took the red rose out of his lapel, put it down, changed his vote because of his mother, and it passed by one vote.
Wow.
So don't ever think that one vote does not matter.
And we have seen that over and over again.
In local elections,
we've had three vote differences.
Or recounts over and over. Yeah, three, five. It's very common. Many Montana legislative races are won and lost by fewer than 100 votes.
Yeah.
So your vote does matter. And with absentee ballots, the majority of people in Montana now vote absentee. Missoula's will be probably about 70% this time. In some places, like Great Falls and Miles Billings, it's like 90%, and that's because all our polling places are really in one place, and it's easiest to vote absentee. But you get your absentee ballot in the mail, you can look at it, you can read the directions, you can call your friends and say, I have no idea who's running for
whatever. Right, you can check
whatever.
Facebook. And
yeah, check them out, hold on to it, but get it in, you know. So a lot of people were sent ballots, and some of you won't get it in, so dig it out of that pile. You got it last week. You've had it for a while. And
what if you can't find it? What if you know you got one and you can't find
it? If you can't find it, you can still go to your polling place, and you'll end up talking to me, and you will cast a provisional ballot. First of all, I'll say, are you sure you can't find it? Can you? Where is it? The dog ate it? What happened?
Right. Recycling.
If it's
went
just
out,
your two, you know, it's sitting there, I'm going to send you home to get it. Okay. If you can't find it or whatever has happened to it, you will cast a provisional ballot. And they will open those and they count them the day after the election. So if it's a close vote, it still makes a real difference. So you do still get to vote and your vote still does count.
Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
And if you have your absentee ballot and comes election day and you still haven't mailed it, don't mail it at the end. You can bring it and turn it in at any polling place on election day.
You cannot mail it. It's not postmarked. It has to be in.
Well, and we have a special arrangement with the post office to deliver. They deliver these ballots up to 8 o'clock that night.
Okay.
So they really go out of their way to get them in. Right. But if you throw it in the mail on election day, we're not going to get it to be able to count it. So if you've held on to it that long, just bring it in to either the election office out at the fairgrounds anytime in Missoula, or your election office, whatever town you're in, which is usually in your courthouse. Or you can take it to any polling place, and you drop it off there. That's all that's required.
Okay.
And it will be counted.
We do still try to make it easy here in Montana, and I hope that that can continue. Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks for all your work. So hopefully we'll all get out and vote, and hopefully we'll get some really smart women elected to the next state legislature.
Yeah, we need some smart men and women. We need some of both. You know, because I really think some of these issues, you know, that we've continued to think of as women legislators. You know, I'm not a woman legislator. I'm a legislator. I'm not a gay legislator. I was the first out elected gay official in the state. Doesn't even cross my mind, actually. I'm not a gay legislator. I'm a legislator. Right. I also happen to be a woman from eastern Montana, white, a lesbian, et cetera, a Democrat. I got a long list of things, but I'm not any of those. We are all just legislators. And so it's really important to think about why you're electing this particular person. Do they represent the values and perspectives that you want to have represented up there?
And if you don't know, ask them.
If you don't know, ask me a question.
Or in the next week, right, yeah.
Go online. There's tons of information everywhere.
Yeah. So, Diane, what do you think will be some of the big issues debated at the next, you know, we have this every other year session, 90 days, fast and furious. What's going to be hot? What's going to be big?
Well, what's going to be hot, at least three things will be hot. One will be Medicaid expansion. Whether we'll do that or how we will do that. I mean, that's been actually a debate for decades, trying to raise it to 138% of poverty. We haven't succeeded at that. But there are a number of different mechanisms. I mean, the biggest one, of course, is to take the federal money as part of the Affordable Care Act. If that passes or not will depend on who's in control of the legislature. If the House and Senate are both in Republican hands, the chance of that passing is very small. But there are some other proposals of ways to do it. Secondly, will be the early childhood initiative of the governor, too. We're one of the few states left that doesn't really provide any funding for early childhood education.
Yeah, and 42 states have this.
Most people understand at this point, you know, that 1 to 5, you know, those are the important years. If those children are successful and healthy, learn to read, et cetera, their chance of graduating from high school and having a productive life goes way up. If they don't, you know, you're going to pay for it now or you're going to pay for it later. You're going to pay for it in kids who don't have the skills to be able to participate in the workforce or to be successful. So it's important for our economy to pass that. I don't know if that's going to pass. There is, there'll be money in the budget to do that, but I'm sure that will be a huge fight because many of the Republicans in the past have talked about every time we've had funding for childcare issues, government babysitting, government. You know, that's the fundamental difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Democrats have a more expansive view of the role of government, that it is for the general welfare and things that we can do collectively for each other that better society. Republicans' view, and while I don't agree with this, I think it's a legitimate point of view, is very narrowly structured. The government's roles are extremely small and only those in the original Constitution, and that any other areas are really not appropriate for government to be involved in. And so that's the line that they take. So they would therefore be opposed to Medicaid expansion and opposed to expansion of or putting any money into early childhood education. Those two will be huge. For Western Montana, the other one will be the water compact between the Salish Kootenai and the state, which also faces an uphill battle.
Right. Yeah. And then there's all these smaller issues that different people follow. I know we've talked about on this show some about some different ideas about renewable energy and actually getting a bit more options for people for distributed energy and things that kind of
And some of us are still working on women's economic equality. You know, the fights over equal pay for equal work are still out there. Family and medical leave issues, all of those. I mean, women. I mean, I'm always appalled that when I first started doing some of this work back in the 60s and 70s, I have a button that says 69 cents. And at that point, that's what women were getting for working full-time and equivalent jobs to men's. And now it's up to 73, 74 cents. Whoopee. You know, between the number of women in the legislature, someone projected it out to be like 300 years before women are hold equal numbers in the legislature. Well, sometimes it feels like it's going to be another 300 years before women are paid equally in the society with men as well. That has a huge impact on families and our economy. People having to hold two or more jobs, you know, and particularly in a state like this where the median income is at the very bottom of the nation anyway, and we have such a huge number of people in poverty. So those issues, if we want to talk about the economic well-being of the state as a whole and the health and well-being of our families, those issues must be addressed.
Front and center, right. So you mentioned you were the first gay legislator for Montana.
Out, and not out. The first
oh,
one.
Oh, thank you. That's okay.
There have been plenty that have been closeted over the years.
Sure. And then There are a couple others that are out currently.
Yeah, Senator is there anything from Helena and Bryce Bennett is the first gay man in Montana from here in Missoula.
He's my legislator.
And we've had several others that have served and no longer serve, too.
Are there going to be issues that come up in the legislature?
I think the most interesting one that's going to come up this session is because of the action by the Supreme Court and at the federal court level over the marriage amendment. And Montana has this horrible language in my beloved Constitution that says marriage is only between a man and a woman. And clearly, I mean, everyone says under the current action of the federal Supreme Court and the regional court,
Ninth Circuit.
The challenge the ACLU has just dropped back in there. They're asking for a summary judgment just to overturn that, which the court has done for Idaho and Alaska. They're clearly going to do it for Montana. So probably by the time this show is heard, we may even have had a ruling on that. But I expect that will happen before we go into session in January. Now, technically, there's nothing we have to do.
That's what I wondered, right.
But some of us intend to propose a variety of legislation. I mean, the first thing people should know is it's still legal to discriminate against me in terms of housing, employment, and jobs. You could fire me solely based on that.
You can maybe get married, but you can still
be fired, lose your housing, kicked out of a restaurant. Absolutely. Until we're included in the Montana Human Rights Act, that reality is there. Now, we have been working on that since the early 90s, and when we failed to get it through the legislature, I worked with Governor Mark Roscoe, who was very supportive of that issue, and we did go through administrative rule processes and make it so that all state employees were protected in terms of hiring. And then city councils and county commissions across the state of Montana have also done that in for local government. The teachers' unions and schools have done it for schools. So it's sort of a patchwork quilt in terms of employment, but there is no guarantee in the private sector or protection based on sexual orientation or for being served in public accommodations. And, you know, it should be there. It's a really basic protection.
We'll get there. All right. Well,
there's much work to be done on many human rights issues.
Yeah, there are, both here in the state in Montana and around the world.
Just the final thing I'd say is it's really an honor to be a legislator, and I would encourage everybody out there to think of yourself in serving in some public service role. It's a great honor and so interesting, the things that you learn about and the right to represent your neighbors. So whether you want to run for the city council or serve on a board or commission, we have a law in Montana that some of us passed in 83 that requires gender balance and racial parity on all boards and commissions. You want to get involved. We have hundreds of boards and commissions in the state of Montana that regulate everything from, you know, agriculture to child care, mental health to the Board of Investments. Put your name in. There's many ways to serve. You don't just have to run for some high-profile job like the U.S. Senate or a legislative seat, which isn't all that high-profile. But consider yourself asked. Consider yourself asked at some point in your life to be involved in serving your community through either an appointed office or an elected office. It's really an important and very fun part of our responsibility in a democracy.
And a fascinating way to meet people who may not, you may not otherwise meet, you may not get to know otherwise.
You don't. And actually, I'm kind of known as the Miss Manners of the legislature, actually, for this, is because it is a place where we learn how to disagree. And it's important to learn how to disagree in a civil way. It's a place that invites in all of the conflict. It doesn't try to make it go away. You know, and while I don't have any enemies, I have opponents on one issue, and they may be an ally in another. Mm-hmm. I may not agree with them on this, but it's my job also to understand as deeply as I can why they view it that way. And maybe we can find some compromise on various issues. And that's important in a democracy. If we do not find a way to civilly work with each other to resolve some of these problems, we will resort to violence. And that is not a future I want for my community and my country. And that's why I choose to work very hard at trying to find a way to work with people of all different political issues to accomplish really basic and important things for people. Unfortunately, I think at the federal level, that's broken down. Mm-hmm. In a way that's simply horrifying to me. But at a state level, it still generally works fairly well over the long haul.
Yeah, it's always fun to see some folks that come together on an issue that you would never imagine people from Colstrip and Missoula,
Yeah, and it's not okay just to call people names or to just write things off as being crazy. They're not crazy. They view it in a different way. They may have a very rational perspective on it. May not be one I agree with, but there is a philosophical and often experiential basis for people's perspectives on things. And so you really owe it to other people, other human beings, your neighbors, to listen to them deeply and really try to say, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I don't agree with that. But until we can learn to do that, we are really in danger of letting our democracy be weakened and fall apart, and I am very worried about that.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that we can, at the federal level, turn things around over the years. It can come back. We don't have time.
The state level is where we practice, and at the local level, at your city council and county commission, and on these boards and commissions and in the state, that's where we're a small state. There's not that many of us. We can learn to work together, and we need to make a commitment to do that.
All right. Well, we will all be voting in the next week, and we will be very interested to see the outcome of that voting exercise, and we'll be with you and paying attention come January. So, Diane Sands, it's been really fun. This hour just flew by. I appreciate your time and your public service over the many, many years, and also your enthusiasm for history. I'm dedicated to making sure that my daughter and others who are teenagers and have really don't get history. They're going to get some. So thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure. I'm delighted.
Okay. This is In Other Words Radio. Again, you can listen to this show on inotherwordsradio.com. And I would like to thank Beth Ann Ostine for producing today, helping us with the show. And have a good night.